Hello, dumplings. Welcome to Let's Get Ugly, the podcast where we dive deep into the latest beauty, wellness, and lifestyle secrets that aren't always pretty, but always real.
We're your co-hosts, Trisha and Disha.
The sister duo keeping it 100% authentic, really silly and sassy all at the same time.
We're super silly and a little bit sassy, so come grab your favorite drink and join us on this episode of Let's Get Ugly. Nina, welcome.
Thank you so much. So excited to have this conversation with you both today.
Yeah, we can't wait. I mean, your journey is so interesting, obviously as being founder and CEO of Cult Mia now, but before that you were in finance. You even worked at the UN for a little bit as well. I mean, your journey is just so remarkable and we love the platform and what you stand for. So we're really excited to dive into that.
We're super excited today to be talking about sustainability, innovation in fashion, and really your power to empower independent designers. My first question to you is actually about your entrepreneurial journey, because Cult Mia is really truly a one-of-a-kind platform. What sparked your passion to support independent designers?
So I guess we get to go back to the beginning. I would say there were three key light bulb moments that led to Cult Mia. The first was at the UN that you mentioned. I had a stint there. I worked in an incredible team called Women in Trade, and we were helping women-owned micro-enterprises in the least developed countries in the world and connecting them with global sales opportunities. So all of a sudden, you could buy Mongolian cashmere through the Hermes stores, a partnership that happened through the UN, and within that, they started to launch more ethical fashion initiatives. So back in 2013, 2014, the UN came to London Fashion Week for the first time and launched an ethical fashion show. Sustainability, and I guess that's one of the themes we're going to touch on, wasn't as relevant or prevalent in the fashion industry. So I would say that that show almost a decade ago didn't have the traction that hopefully it would have today. But it really left, I would say, the first seed that led to Cult Mia. From there, while I was doing my MBA here in London, I worked for a luxury e-tailer called Mode Operandi. They're the equivalent to Farfetch or Net-a-Porter based in the US predominantly. And I had a really simple realization, which was the few brands that you had never heard of on Moda were selling as much as the Gucci's on the platform. And this got me thinking, okay, the luxury shopper is clearly getting bored of finding the same products and brands across all the luxury platforms out there. And finding luxury online was no longer a novelty. You could shop from Gucci.com as well. You could shop from Harrods.com. So clearly people were looking for unique fashion, but they were also starting to ask more interesting questions around the sustainability and ethics behind these pieces. So everything that touches on how designers produce, the materials that they use, basically the vetting of values behind designers and products, but that as an individual takes a lot of time, and where would you really even know where to begin? And then the third light bulb moment was very simply, I'm from Mexico originally, although I've been in London for over 10 years, and whenever I went back home to Mexico and I picked up, I don't know, some amazing shell enameled earrings from a market in Oaxaca, people used to stop me on the street in London. They would never ask me about my high street sneakers, but always about my unique finds that I would pick up maybe back home or on travels. And I used to have to say, oh my gosh, well, you need to travel to Oaxaca to get them. And now I can point you to Cult Mia. So together with these, you know, three big kind of moments and realizations that I had, I decided to launch the independent fashion marketplace for the world and really shine a spotlight on the amazing artisans, creators, and designers that we think will be the next big names in fashion.
That's amazing. I mean, I think one of the main things is when you kind of launched, how has your vision changed from then to now? Because there have been so many changes in the industry as well.
Yeah. A couple big ones come to mind. So the first, I actually set up an Instagram page as a little soft test to see how much interest people would have in discovering new brands. And it was called Moda Latina because I was from Mexico and I thought, okay, there was clearly a lot of, you know, interest in Latin fashion at the time. And the first quick pivot I made was, okay, there's amazing talented designers all over the world. Why limit myself to just Latin America? And the second was I actually started the business with a consignment model, which means I was holding the inventory here in London, not buying it, but holding it. And then COVID hit. And then I realized very quickly, one of the biggest challenges to scaling would be actually having to house the inventory, carry the inventory risk, all the logistics around fulfilling orders, and we pivoted to a dropship model. And within that first year, we were able to convince over 100 brands from about 40 different countries to join the platform. And that sell would have been very different had we kind of stayed with our original business setup. Lots of other, you know, changes and pivots throughout the last 5 years, but those were the first big two that got us started.
I think the first question I have with regards to that is dropship requires a little bit of waiting some time. So if you browse the Cultmia website today, you've got some pieces that are obviously ready to go and other pieces that take a little bit of time. Could you talk us through that consumer journey? Because we live in a world of Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
So how does your customer react to that?
Yeah, it's a good question and one that the team debates internally quite a bit. So probably close to 50% of the brands that you see on Cultmia are made to order. We love working with these brands because from a sustainability standpoint, there's no overproduction, there's no waste, and you know, there's craftsmanship behind what you're wearing. You're both wearing Andriva today, which is one of our made-to-order brands actually. And I'd caveat made-to-order with, it doesn't mean it's going to take forever. Our average fulfillment time is under 2 weeks. So it's made-to-order relatively quickly for you. But yes, it's not going to compete with the Amazon Prime, like instant, you know, get it by tonight mindset. But I think what we found with our customer is when you come to Cultmia, you're discovering brands, you're discovering unique pieces, and close to half of what you see on the platform, you can only shop through us. And that means that, well, one, we're your only choice, so you're going to have to wait 2 weeks for those pieces. But two, I think we invest a lot of time really explaining why it makes sense to shop in that way and hopefully incentivizing a more considered purchase and hopefully more sustainable behaviors over time. And then I guess going back to your initial question on kind of or mention of wanting to empower younger, newer brands, a lot of times having to produce wholesale and have a lot of units available to send now really crowds out a lot of designers from joining online platforms. They don't have the capital available to buy the materials, pre-produce, meet the requirements for big wholesaler holding lots of inventory on their end. So working with brands on a made-to-order basis makes a lot of sense in terms of being able to champion younger designers who aren't really there yet in terms of the production requirements that are needed.
And I think that's a big struggle, especially within the industry when there are so many new designers coming to light and they have a lot of samples for their first collections, and it's often hard to kind of take that next step. So it's really exciting to see that. I just wanted to ask, when it comes to the platform in general, how do you go about scouting the designers?
That's one of my favorite questions. We look at two core, I would say, scouting pillars, let's call them. And by the way, we actually lean on our community for brand recommendations. So we constantly ask our community and our customers, if you do come across an amazing brand on one of your travels, please send it to us and we'll bring them home for you so you can kind of access them outside of that specific trip, because a lot of times we'll take brands out of their home countries for the first time. We might work with some of Mexico's biggest designers and they've never figured out how to scale outside of Mexico. So not to divert too much attention, but little side note, if you do, anyone listening, come across cool brands that you can't shop through the UK or wherever you're based, send them our way. Right now, around 250 brands apply to join Cultmia every month. And we accept around 10% because the vetting process, back to your question, we're picky. We look at everything you'd expect a fashion business to look at. So quality, making sure it aligns on, you know, price point expectations. Is it meeting our merchandising plan? Is it on trend, etc.? And the second pillar has to do with ethics. So we do a huge, huge sustainable sourcing framework that we put brands through that we developed with an organization called Positive Luxury. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're kind of a B Corp for luxury fashion. You might have seen the butterfly mark on a few different brands out there. And we look at everything from animal welfare policies to materials used to production processes. And we give brands a score. And that doesn't mean we're saying the brands you find on Cult Me are doing everything perfectly on the sustainability front. That's not reasonable to expect from younger brands, and no one is. But it means there's a baseline that we require to join. So there are some clear no's. And then we tier you into different sustainability buckets, depending on where you are in your journey. And we give you recommendations on how to improve your ESG scores with us. And we reward you if you do. So we're really working to incentivize designers to scale sustainably with us. And I take it, you know, as a real responsibility as a platform, as a retailer, to share the knowledge that we have, knowing that we're working with, you know, brands that don't have access to the same resources or knowledge.
That's amazing. I think, like, also when it comes to trends and noticing trends, it would be really interesting to know, what are the ones that you notice right now? And how are you integrating them into your platform?
In terms of trends, maybe we can split it across customer facing and then designer facing.
Yeah.
Because I guess we're a two-sided platform, so why not? On the customer front, I think what's amazing about the Cult Mia business model is we can go from meeting a new brand to being live on site within a week. The agility that our marketplace gives us means we can pick up on changes in consumer preferences and trends basically immediately. We had to do that and put our model to the test during COVID, where we were going to launch a huge evening wear collection in March 2020. No one was going to buy a ball gown once the pandemic happened and everyone was staying home. And we were able to introduce activewear, home, sleepwear, loungewear within a week. So that's a very dramatic example of needing to change across product categories and assortments. But it just goes to say, for example, maybe you checked our Instagram lately. We've been talking a lot about espresso themes, you know, chocolate. Everything is, you know, shades of brown this season. In the last month, we've really focused on onboarding the coolest brands that would meet the new color palette for next year, the Pantone of the year. I think, is it called Mocha? I think
Mocha Mousse.
Anyways, so once that was announced, we're like, all right, let's onboard Mocha Mousse. And I think it's a real strength that we have to have that flexibility and agility.
Amazing.
So obviously within the retail landscape, there have been many big fashion retailers that have shut down in the last few years, and there have been a lot of dips within the industry. How have you guys been able to stay competitive in that time period?
It's been a really interesting time to scale Cult Mia, and I'm really proud of our team and the fact that we've been able to really buck some of these industry trends. And we tripled our business in size this year, where, you know, I think we've seen that the industry more broadly has really struggled. And when I zoom out and really think about what we're doing differently, it's essentially avoiding all the industry pitfalls that I think have affected some of these big players. The most important one for me is, and we kind of touched on it at the beginning, is having a differentiated product assortment. You should not be finding Cult Mia brands and products elsewhere or in many other places. I think what really kind of started to bring down the Matches and Farfetch and Net-a-Porters is, you know, a sterile and undifferentiated product offering, which meant they had to compete on price. And the only winners in that battle were Meta and Google from all the paid spend that they were turning out to acquire customers that weren't going to be loyal to them because they didn't really understand why shop on one platform versus the other when the product and service was pretty much the same. But the second maybe builds on that, which is we don't rely on discounts as a business. Discounts are less than 7% of our turnover. We really focus on the product cutting through the noise rather than the bargain as a acquisition strategy. And then I would say another big one is focusing on our digital platform. I think a lot of businesses try and maybe conquer online and traditional retail, and traditional retail has been very, very difficult as of late. That doesn't mean there won't be an opportunity to do, you know, a cool pop-up strategy and build out brand awareness in key places, but I think we've seen some of these big players try and do physical retail in an incredibly expensive way. And then the fourth that comes to mind is being relevant to the shopper of the future. I can't tell you that people buy something today just because it's sustainable. We're not there yet, but I can tell you that the longstanding platforms weren't really appealing to the values of the millennial customer and the Gen Z customer. And millennials and Gen Zs drove 100% of the luxury industry's growth in the last 2 years. So if you aren't resonating with them and you don't have a different product offering and you have crazy overheads and costs to keep your businesses afloat, it's going to be really challenging. But I would say, to keep this not too long because it is one of my favorite topics, you know, there's a lot of sentiment that luxury e-commerce, you know, it's not a good business, or it's, you can't have a solid business in the space. The appetite for online shopping isn't going anywhere. The appetite for luxury isn't going anywhere either. And it's just about really thinking about the fundamentals behind a business that you want to grow in the space to be really resilient.
I think that's so important. And I think when it comes to technology, it obviously is the constantly changing landscape. I mean, AI is something that I feel like was really a hot topic of conversation in the last 6 months. Mm. You know, everybody's really kind of going off the rails, even though, of course, it's been there for a very long time. I was curious to know whether AI or technology is something that you're planning or are already infusing into Kalamea.
Tech is an interesting consideration, where a lot of startups or a lot of founders put a lot of pressure on having to invest a lot in tech at the start. For Kalamea, it's not a key differentiator. Our focus is having the most exciting and exclusive selection of the brands of tomorrow and making sure the shopping experience is seamless enough and at the luxury level of expectation. That doesn't mean we haven't invested in tech at all. Like, we have focused on automating a lot of processes and making sure the back end works in a really sleek way, but it's not, I would say, a core differentiator. It will become, I believe, in the future, once we've really built out the business and then we're thinking about, okay, how can we keep growing? But the growth is very much there, and we can't focus on everything at this stage. And there's people purely focusing on retail tech who are doing it very well, spending a lot of money in developing their different technologies, who we'll be able to partner with. I don't know if you guys know Julie Bornstein. She sold, is it the Yes, I think it's called, to Pinterest, the kind of visual recognition technology. Amazing, amazing business. And she's about to launch Daydream. And she did a pilot at the Business of Fashion's Voices Summit that I was at last month. And it's essentially a ChatGPT for shopping. You're like, okay, I want to go to a Roaring Twenties party. Give me some recommendations, pulling products from all over. And then you're like, actually, I like this, but change this, show me this. It's incredible. That use of AI, I can really see as being part of the future of fashion for Kalamea. We're partnering, kind of, we're in their beta tests with them. Anything that touches on efficiency for me when it comes to the back end, but also personalization on the front end, I'm all for integrating into our business.
I think it's going to make such a difference, honestly, because I feel like right now we rely so much on Meta ads, or we rely a lot on Google Display ads. Mm. And I feel like this is something that is so specifically targeted. It will at least hopefully regain or reintegrate the customer retention, which I think every platform really does desire.
AI is going to change everything. I'm no expert, but you know, one of my 2025 kind of personal goals is to just really stay up to date on all the different AI opportunities that will become available to Kalamea and see where we get to.
I think that's so cool.
That's really great. And yes, technology and fashion, I mean, I feel like it's a bit of an interesting one just because there have been so many innovations at the same time. And obviously, like, AR is growing. So is digital fashion. And it's just a big landscape within there for sure. But we just wanted to ask you about the future of Kalamea, and which markets or untapped opportunities do you see as key?
So this year has been really interesting in terms of geographical expansion. The Middle East for us grew by 2,000% year on year. Huge, huge appetite from Saudi, UAE, specifically, like, two big bright spots that we're going to double down on next year and really focus on a localized strategy. I'm going to Dubai Fashion Week for the first time in February, really excited about it. There's so much more we can be doing in the region and so much more to learn about the customer and different countries, not to kind of apply a blended approach throughout. We're also really excited about India, seeing lots of healthy kind of organic signals already. And then the US is still our largest market. So although I'm in London, my team's here, we started here, the future for us is about the US and Middle East.
I was also going to ask about values, because sustainable values are obviously different in those two regions. So I wanted to ask, like, how do you balance your messaging while still staying true to who you guys are?
We haven't taken a regional approach in communicating our values. So it's quite consistent and kind of still the pillar of our mission statement and how we present the business both to brands and to customers. I think what will differ between the markets potentially is the ranking order in which they fall. So some customers might go through and go to a product on the Cult Mia website and say, okay, I'm comfortable with the price. I think the fit will be good. It will arrive in time. Oh, and great, plus it's a woman made and owned brand that was handcrafted in Colombia using sustainable materials. Extra tick, I'm definitely buying it. For others, it might come higher up in the journey. That's how I think the two markets might be behaving differently. But like I said, I wish I could tell you it's the first thing people think about when they're buying something. We're not there yet.
Of course.
We do have some beauty-related questions for you, which is a segment that we carry out for each of our guests, and they're quick fire. Are you ready?
Ooh.
So the first question is, what's one beauty rule you love breaking?
Ooh, I use mascara as eyebrow gel. Ooh.
That's actually really a good use of that product. I need to try.
Apparently, it's not great for your eyebrows, so maybe don't do it.
But how do you get it from not smudging?
I put very little bits on the ends. I find, because I have big eyebrows, let's say, any kind of gel just looks crispy and gray and changes the color of my eyebrow. And I've tried so many different products, and I was just actually like, one day I forgot my eyebrow gel and I only had mascara and I just whizzed it across and I was like, wow, that's a winner, 2-in-1.
Wow, I love that. That needs to be a multi-purpose product, I think. You're onto something there.
Definitely, definitely. If you could give your younger self one piece of beauty advice, what would it be?
I think when I was younger, I didn't fully appreciate how youthful you can look with fuller cheeks. And rather than trying to get a more like chiseled contour look, like embrace it. It's part of looking fresh and young and being really happy about it, because as you get older, normally that changes.
Great.
What's a beauty moment, good or bad, that you'll never forget?
So getting my makeup trial for my wedding, I think I must have tried 3 or 4 different makeup artists, and the use of the word natural. My definition of natural and the makeup artist was so different. And I came out and my parents were sitting around watching, waiting. And I think my dad, you know, shrieked. He was like, are we getting ready for Halloween? Or like, what is going on? So I think maybe having a really clear mood board before you think about your wedding looks is super important. And the regional differences, we were in Mexico, which is quite like smoky eye, heavy, dramatic makeup. I wasn't ready for that.
I love that. Did you get married in Mexico then?
I did. Oh, I did.
Amazing. I bet the weather was so good.
There wasn't much of a question when I, you know, was talking to my husband about destination. I was like, potentially rainy, cloudy, gray London or Mexico? Are we even going to talk about this?
Yeah, there was no debating.
There's no debate.
Yeah. That's amazing. Well, we have a final segment where we do a little oracle card reading for you. So it is just going to be one for the year ahead, a little message. Okay, so, message for you.
Ooh.
Take a break.
I hear it. I hear it. I hope my team sees that too.
They definitely will. Please let Nina have a break, guys. It's just more to kind of to start the year, I guess, like take the time off, have a reset, and then get back into it. So I think it's more like come to the new year with a refreshed point of view. So
you're
try not to work over the holidays.
And guess what? My vacation starts just after this. So very, very relevant and on point.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for taking us through your incredible journey today. I love the way that you are redefining the map of what luxury fashion is and the way that you guys empowered independent designers, embrace innovation. It truly is an inspiration.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a treat.
Amazing.